Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com. If we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict predecided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look at these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air, as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make, if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedies in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if we can disclose properly and then answer properly, then we can all learn something from it.
All right, Martin, thank you so very much. We appreciate your comments. And turn that recording off. Very good. Thank you, sir. Tonight, we may have something a little bit different. In fact, I'm sure it's going to be very different. You know that the information provider sometimes will hit a wall with a deadline and have to just remove all distractions from them, other commitments, and tend to that call. John tonight, and as of last night, when I spoke with him around midnight, I guess it was my time, he was covering what he was going to cover today with regards to personal jurisdiction, and it was going to be a very interesting call. But I got a call from John about 40 minutes ago where he had said that something came up in one of his students' cases that he had to make a brief in response to and has to have it in the court by opening of the court tomorrow, which is probably 8 a.m. So John is not going to be joining us tonight, a last-minute bailout. I apologize that to everybody. However, that doesn't mean this is going to be a dead issue tonight. First off, I want to draw attention to a gentleman that's on the call right now that was the lead investigator for a former information provider, Mr. Tony Davis. Johnny, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Johnny, I'm going to put you in a position, and I apologize, multiple apologies in advance, but would you mind talking tonight, after I clear the board a little bit, would you mind talking tonight about some of the things that you've discovered in your investigations, possibly uniquely with Title 18, that you were doing work with Mr. Davis on? Would you consider doing that without any preparation at all?
If you give me a couple of minutes to get my notes together here.
Do that, and I'm going to take care of this board. I've got a first-time caller here from Compton, California, a phone number ending in 2632. Would you like to share your first name and tell you how you found us tonight? Compton, California, ending in 2632. Would you like to introduce yourself? Well, I guess not. Well, welcome to the call, whoever you are. Let me get this closed up here. And Michael from Las Vegas, how are you this evening?
Pretty good. I mentioned something about a case in San Diego, and the driver, the over-the-road driver, said he knew about that case. Has he gotten back with you on that?
No, sir, he has not.
Oh, okay. So I'll just wait until he gives you a reply then.
Why don't you do this? His name is Tom. So just say Tom was on the call, or just send me an email or a text. Tom was on the call and talked about whatever it was, and I will prompt him. Okay?
Okay. Yeah, that'll work. Thanks, buddy.
Sure. Thank you. A little background here before we bring Johnny Ringo. That's what he likes to be called. Before we bring Johnny aboard for talking with us tonight, I had an information provider that I did marketing for the better part of a decade, if not a little bit more than a decade. And his name is Tony Davis. And if you go back in the archives, beyond 3 years, maybe 4 years ago, that was his last calls with us. Since then, he passed away. That's what we were told. And I haven't seen him and haven't been able to do any follow-up with him. But his lead investigator that he had is Johnny Ringo. And Johnny has done a lot of work on a broad number of subjects. And the one that was the one that hit home to me hardest of all and most importantly is Title 18, because of his discoveries about it actually not being properly enacted and promulgated into law. So you're going to hear about that tonight. We'll turn the call over to him as soon as he's ready.
Okay, anytime.
You're good to go. So tell us, Johnny, what your experience has been with Title 18, how you got started sniffing around that, and then what have you discovered over the years?
Well, I was incarcerated in 2002 to 2005 in Leavenworth, Kansas, and my time spent there, I started talking to an attorney who was there on Medicare fraud. And we started researching Title 18, and it got because most of your drug convictions and a lot of other convictions are under Title 18, of which was supposedly passed in 1948, but it never was. How it started out is Title 18 came up in front of the House of Representatives in 1947. And it was voted upon, but they never had what they call a quorum, which is they need a majority of the House to pass the bill. But in 1947, there was 412 representatives in the House of Representatives. And when this bill was brought up for a vote, there was a vote of 47 for and 6 against. So there was absolutely no quorum ever reached. And then the bill was sent to the Senate, Congress, where they debated the bill, but it was of an entirely different form. The understanding is that a bill, in order to be passed into a legal statute, has got to be passed by the House and the Senate, and it must have the exact same content or wording. It never did. The bill that was sent to the Senate was a completely different wording. And then they voted on it, but there was absolutely no quorum ever reached in the Senate. And then in December 24th, it was taken up to the White House, and the bill was signed by President Truman at that time. But in reality, in order for a bill to be passed, there are several qualifications. The same bill must be passed by the House and the Senate, exactly, by a majority of each House. Neither one happened. And also, when a bill is presented to the president, it must be presented to him when the House and the Senate are in session. Well, Truman signed this in December 24th, 1948. Neither House was in session. They both had been adjourned for the Christmas holidays. And Truman went and signed it. And then it must be published in the local Register of Washington, which was to be published for 6 weeks, once every week, in the National Journal. It never was. So the statute has never, ever legally become a legal law or statute. And present to this time, there are 5,173 statute in Title 18 or laws of which they prosecute under it. The Justice Department prosecutes. And a year and a half ago, I went to several, by request, by several senators and representatives of about 2 years ago, and I explained this entirely situation to them because I had complete paperwork from the House of Representatives, the National Archives, and the Library of Congress, complete certified documentation that there never was a quorum in either Senate or the House. And I presented this information to about 30, give or take a couple, senators and representatives in Washington, D.C. And I presented all the complete documents, certified documents, from the Library of Congress right to them. And they all agreed that something had to be done. Well, about a year after my conference with them, the Justice Department issued an inner office memorandum that there should be absolutely no more prosecutions taken under Title 18, of which somebody evidently it got lost by all the prosecutors in through the entire country because they are still doing it. And I've got 22 years of research under this. And the document, I've got 112 pages of certified documents from the Library of Congress and the National Archives stating that there was absolutely no quorum ever reached on Title 18 when it was brought up before the House in 1947 and the Senate in 1948. This statute has been under investigation, and it also came up again in the United States Code, 1964 edition. The seventh edition of the United States Code was prepared and published in several sections. I won't go into the section because it's kind of mind-boggling and everything. But in as much as the general and permanent laws which are required to be incorporated in a code are inconsistent, redundant, and obsolete, the Committee on the Judiciary is engaged in a comprehensive project of revising and enacting the code into law by title. Title 18 was never included into this, and they absolutely admitted that it was never a statute, and yet they have been prosecuting literally, give me a chance here, 7.7 million individuals. Now, this is as of 2020, They've prosecuted probably a hell of a lot more since then under Title 18. These people are sitting in prison under a law that does not exist legally. And I've presented documentation to several courts, and I testified in the Supreme Court under this. And those individuals came up with the conclusion on this particular case that the statute is not viable. And that was their decision. So I'll leave it up to you to make up what that means. It does not apply to the situation at hand, evidently. There's been, of my records that I have got certified, there's been 56 cases brought up before the Supreme Court, but all of these cases involve very, very influential government, should we say employees, elected employees, and each and every time these cases came under the definition of being sealed for the simple reason they found out that what they were being prosecuted under did not exist. But they never brought it out into the public eye. And this is the corruption of the United States federal system and the court system. You've got administrative executives, which people call judges, and they are not judges. There hasn't been a judge in this country since 1798. But they want to call themselves honorable. Well, I find it very difficult for any person to be called honorable who is sending another person to be incarcerated under a falsified statute. I've questioned several prosecutors if they have ever researched this law. They all look at me like I'm crazy, and they say, why would we research? It's on the books. I says, it's not on the books. I talked to the chancellor of Northwestern University. This happened about 3, maybe 4 years ago, if my memory serves me right. They had two summer school classes. Each class contained, one was 17 and the other one of 18 students, and they had two law professors. And this was their main study for 8 weeks in summer school. And their documentation came up that the statute of Title 18 never legally became into law. It never existed. I had fairly good friend of, he was an administrative assistant, and he wrote a personal letter stating that Title 18 never legally existed, and he was a very recognized man throughout the judicial system in Wisconsin. Of course, he was a state administrative, but he studied my paperwork and also his library, of which I inherited, which is very extensive, and him and seven of his associates, which were lawyers and three other administrative managers, all came to the conclusion that Title 18 does not and never has legally existed. And I presented paperwork to several law firms, of which I'm associated with, and when this whole situation comes up, they run for cover. They will not investigated any further. I've probably investigated it as far as any living soul could possibly do it. I spent 22 years in the research of this, and the paperwork proves it. Documentation paper proves it undeniably, and yet they are refusing to accept it for the simple reason the liability is so far extensive within to the civil suit cases that could be brought against the federal government. It would, I believe they would call it, they created the RICO Act to convict organized crime. Well, when you start looking into this organization of the federal marshals, the U.S. courts, the prosecuting attorneys, and the incarceration institutions that are all involved in this, there are literally hundreds of billions of dollars involved. And when I have no idea how many people have been incarcerated since 2020, but my records have well over 7 million people that have been incarcerated under this illegal statute. So, I wish I would have had a little bit more time, and that I could have. I've just got some letters. Now, this is from the Office of the Clerk, U.S. House of Representatives, Washington, D.C., on June 28, 2000. Thank you for your letter requesting information on Title 18. In response to your inquiry, Congress was in session on June 1st, 3rd, 4th, 7 to 12, and 4 to 19, 1948. However, Title 18 was not voted on at this time. As you may know, Title 18 covers 45 pages, this is in 2008, in the U.S. Code, and this wording was developed over many years. Signed copies of laws are archived in the National Archives and Records Administration and are not available to the public. I hope that I have been of some assistance to you. For future references, most federal depository libraries possess this type of information. From the depository library closet to you, please consult the government printing office on website www.gov/libraries. Sincerely, Jeff Trudeau. This is just one of the correspondence. Here's one from August 30th, 2006. According to the House Journal, House Concurrent Resolution number 219 was agreed to by the House on June 18th, 1948. And passed by the Senate without an amendment. The names of those House members who agreed on H.Con Resident 219 were not entered into the House Journal, which is a mandatory requirement. The House Journal and the Congressional Record on June 18, 1948 states that H.Con Resident 216 was agreed to by a unanimous consent, does not state whether a quorum was present. It was not. There never was a quorum. Excuse the delay here. After
well, you're fine.
Let's see, pages 504S of the Congressional Record on the 80th Congress, first session, indicates 48 members voted, 38-16, to amend H.R. 3190 on May 12, 1947. Therefore, by counting the total yes and nay votes, a quorum was not present. This documentation comes from the Office of the Clerk in the U.S. House of Representatives, and it's dated September 11, 2006. Virtually goes on and on. I mean, with the documented certification that there never was a quorum, it never was legally passed through the House or the Senate. And yet, I presented this documentation to administrative magistrate in Green Bay of the federal court, and 17 people were up before him on Title 18. We went back into his chambers, and he questioned me for about an hour and a half on this, and I presented several documents to him. And at that time, he suspended the cases for 1 year due to an investigation into it. Well, the prosecuting attorney was very ticked off, to say the least. She got the judge suspended for 1 year. And at that time, I had several correspondence with Judge or Administrative Magistrate Griesbach. And at the end of his suspension, he would not even contact me. He had wanted absolutely nothing to do with me. He was scared of losing his job. I talked to the attorney that I forget their name. Anyways, she defends. She's a public defender for on the federal side. And I talked to her, and she says, you opened up a can of worms, and the prosecuting attorney, federal attorney at that time, wanted a judgeship in California. So she brought all the charges she could to make herself look good. Well, after 1 year, everything kind of died down, and nobody wanted anything to do with me. I was investigated by the Homeland Security, which turned out to be they definitely got to hire better individuals in there because they were all basically a joke. I served 9 years in the Marine Corps, and they taught me very well on how to take care of myself. And several of these individuals kind of suffered kind of personal injuries, we might say, frustrating, to say the least, and they were very well humiliated. And after a while, they pulled in their horns and they totally disappeared. And but this is something that has got to be remedied. And at this point, I'm at dead end, because I've exhausted just about every avenue I've known except to inform the public of it. When there's very few attorneys out there that will accept federal cases, and the thing is, when you hire them, what you're doing in reality is hiring an officer of the court. There's foreign officers of the court. So the question arises, are they working for you, or are they working for the court system? I've attended several, multi, 50, 60, maybe 70 cases in the federal court system already. And when this situation arises, all of the defense attorneys, they turn tail and run. They buckle under. When the judge says, we do not accept any of this information is being certified when the documents are given to them boldface in court, and the defense attorneys all turn tail and run because they know their livelihood is online. And when it all boils down to, they want their paycheck, and they do not care a damn about the person that they're defending. It might seem so, but I've seen it time and time again. And that is why 90% of it comes up and, well, we're going to make a deal. I would recommend taking this deal, plea bargaining. And plea bargaining, if you research into plea bargaining, it has got absolutely nothing with the offense involved. It is a contract between you and the legal system. They do not take any in consideration, in my estimation, though I might be wrong, that they take into consideration the offense. As long as they can get their plea bargain, as long as they can get a guilty plea, that's what they're hired for. And when you come up with a plea bargain, it's a contract. It's got nothing to do with the offense or your defense on what was committed, if allegedly. They're looking for a conviction. And when you look in your federal system, my last figures, which are a little outdated of about 6 months or so, it was 98.7% conviction record in the federal system. Now, I have nothing to do with the state system, absolutely nothing, because each individual state has got their own individual laws. But if you're working on the federal system, do the research into the cases that have come up, and 95% are plea bargain deals because their attorneys scare them into the person allegedly that committed the crime. They scare them into saying, you'll accept this because you can get more. So everybody is scared. Their family, everybody says, you know, go ahead and do it. I went through this whole system. I went through the court. I went through a jury trial. But at this time, I did not have the information that I have now. I wish I did. But my lawyer at the time says, take the deal. He says, it's the best one you can get. Well, when you go in front of the administrative magistrate, he does not have to accept that plea bargain. He can come up with his own sentence. And this is unknown to the vast majority of people under prosecution. The administrative magistrate makes the decision. He can accept it or he cannot, or he can reject it. But right. When you sign a plea bargain, it's a contract. It's got nothing to do with your sentence.
Correct. So, all right, Johnny. What we want to add on here is that Johnny's just barely scratched the surface of this with regards to the impact. There are so many frauds that the Congress has willfully and gleefully entertained upon the people, we the people, for the sole purpose of the cash cow that it is. Not only, you know, you've got the course, everybody's well aware, cognizant of the fraudulent income tax. It's fraudulent because of its misapplication. It's not fraudulent unto itself. It has its perfect place in the federal system on federal lands with federal people. But, you know, there's no one on this call that I can see here that's a federal citizen. Everyone here is a citizen of one of several states. So the tax laws don't apply to it. Title 18 is another one. Bureau of Prisons. Gosh, what's their? They got a $9.3 billion budget. And then add to that all the salaries that Johnny was talking about with regards to the attorneys that are involved, the federal government, and so forth that's involved. It's nothing but a huge cash cow at the expense of men and women under a fraudulent Title 18 that was never promulgated, that was never put into law. Another one, and of course this ties dovetail into what we're talking about tonight. Have you ever heard of DOMA? TONA, rather, not DONA, TONA. It's the 13th Amendment, the original 13th Amendment, that forbid anyone from having titles of nobility as a United States citizen. You couldn't have a title of nobility. So what is your attorney called? Esquire? It's
yep.
Just more and more and more. It's going to take a network of millions of people, low millions, not that big, but several million people is all it will take. You know, we've got 330 plus million people in our country today, so it would 10%, 5% would be sufficient to affect the change by being able to network, and that's what the whole goal is that we have here at Your Remedy is in the Law, Americans Restoring America, is to utilize something that we've built called Grassfire Communications to make that happen. Now, we have a lot of hands raised, and so we want to start going through that. Also, I see that Tom has joined us tonight, and Tom, Michael had asked me earlier on the call before you arrived if you had found that California case. We'll get to that in just a moment. But Johnny, did you want to wrap up anything before we open it up to Q&A?
No, I would just like to apologize for not being ready to go, let's say, on your program.
No, I am so grateful. I'm grateful to you that you went. I felt so bad that I blindsided you with this, and I sincerely apologize. I'd never do that. But I got blindsided about 40 minutes before there's new people on the call, so let me explain something that's going on here that you weren't here at the beginning of the call. John had a preparation in place to present to you tonight on the subject of personam jurisdiction, and it was going to be a great call on that particular subject. And he called me up about 40 minutes before it was his time to speak, about 20 minutes before the call started, to tell me that he had a drop-dead deadline that was put on his lap this afternoon with one of his students that has to have a brief finished to be filed first thing in the morning on one of his students' cases. When he agreed to take part in our speaking as an information provider, then that was the caveat or the stipulation was that he would from time to time be put in a position where he had to do the midnight oil, and he did not have time to talk tonight. So he will return next Tuesday, good Lord willing, crick don't rise. But until then, I was blessed that I looked down here, and there's Johnny, and I said, I got to see if I can't pull him up to the speaker, to the telephone here. So let's open the call. First it's Michael, then it's Jennifer, then it's Tom. So we'll start with Michael. Go ahead, Guy.
Well, I'll start with the federal prosecutor he talked about. She knowingly committed fraud. Then we'll start with, after that, the cases that went to the Supreme Court. Need to find out these cases and crack the nut on those, because that's unlawful what they're doing. We have 3,300 grand jury foremen in this country. Surely one of them has a set of cojones and has a little bit of dignity or honor that they're not so corrupt that they could open this up. But then you got the Thomas More Society. You got Open the Books up there in Chicago. You've got Judicial Watch. And you got the Postmaster General, because he's in charge of the bankruptcy. And we're in bankruptcy. We've been in bankruptcy. We're never going to be out of bankruptcy, or the country is never going. The United States corporation is never going to be out of bankruptcy. So the Postmaster General could be authorized and cajoled into looking into this. And there's a lot of leads right there. So
there you go.
If I had the time or the money, I would spend the time to start going after this stuff or to help you. But right now I'm just a little jammed up, but it won't be like that much longer.
I pray not so. Jennifer, if you don't mind, I'm going to skip over you for one moment. I want to bring Tom forward because, Michael, you had a question for Tom.
Yes, Tom. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. I'm driving again. That's my problem, but go ahead.
Well, that case in California where the judge sent the sheriff out to look for jurors, the guy's peers, and he couldn't find any as prescribed by the law. So
that is correct.
Did you ever find that, and what was the case about?
Well, no, I don't remember what the case was about. The main focus of it was exactly what you're talking about. But I'm one of these people that, whatever you want to say, under Title 18, had the whatever of spending 4.5 years bogusly in prison. And I am a felon, and I'm a truck driver, and I'm on the bottom of the totem pole. I get about 1/3 of normal pay, and I haul all the garbage, so I'm 73 years old. I put in 80, 85 hours a week to maybe make $800. And I have to do it because I'm obligated to my family. So I won't be home for 2 weeks. I'm on the road. And my wife said we would go through it. We have been blessed. We have a lot of wonderful, wonderful people that love the Lord and honor Jesus. And we have a lot of papers hidden throughout the country here that we can search, because I have all this stuff you're talking about. I'm sorry I didn't get on the call until 8:30. I don't know your first name, whatever. But you really hit home here. But I have all this stuff in court. And I filed that paper with the Title 18, Tony Davis and Tom Stockheimer. Now, you're talking about Green Bay Court, so you should definitely know that's right in my backyard. Thomas Stockheimer was a gentleman that was picked up by the U.S. Marshals, spent 32 years in prison, and has never been indicted or whatever yet, because they didn't want him to bring out this Title 18 information. Tom Stockheimer was in prison with me. I was blessed. I had the honor of spending much time with him. He knew the Bible. He didn't need a Bible. He would go to church, he'd go to Bible study, and he could read off the verses. Like, it was just phenomenal. And it was his power that saved him, because I heard the doctors at Rochester prison there said, well, you know, Tom should have been dead 4 years ago. We just can't give him enough medication to go down. Well, anyway, that's immaterial. All we know is that it's out there. Now, I had the California case. And I had all the papers from Tony Davis, because before I went to prison, Tony and I was blessed. I had 4 or 5 people, including Michael and his team and everything. But back then, you know, we didn't quite have the diversity of what we do now. But we have everything seated in the courts. And when it went from mail fraud to jurisdiction in Title 18, the FBI and the U.S. Postal Inspector went out of Minnesota, where my case was, went into Wisconsin, into a different jurisdiction, put a frivolous affidavit in front of the judge there, said that I was whatever, and they got a search warrant, and they came in my house and took everything that I had that would have, you know, really made an issue up there in the cities. So, but I do have this stuff, but it's going to take me a while to track it down, because I've got some papers all the way from Florida to Arizona to Kansas City, and I don't have anything all in one place. I didn't trust our wonderful judicial system. So I appreciate it. I really could relate to what you're talking about. I have some information that I would love to share with you, but I can't mention the names on the air here. But I think you would just honor what I would love to share with you guys. So I give Michael permission to share my phone number with you sometime or something. And I apologize for not being able to get that case to you sooner, but I will get it, because it was filed in the courts. And when we brought in Title 18 and we had all the certification and documentation from Tony Davis, after they raided our house and took everything, took my hard drive, took my computer, they took my kids' play chest, They took my maps out of my little camper trailer. They took everything. And when they knew they had it, then they went in and changed the court docket. Those papers that were filed on the court docket do not even exist now.
Wow.
Johnny,
but do we have the names of those agents and the prosecutor that that was doing that?
Well, see, yeah. Well, the prosecutor didn't like me because I filed this personal and jurisdictional, subject matter and personal. I have one of the best papers ever written by the team that was helping me, and they didn't know how to. It's still open. It's never been answered. The court moved together. And Tony Davis and Stockheimer told me that whenever you write into the court, you put in there that they came up with this phrase, compound constructive fraud with scienter. They said definitely put with. It said with scienter on the court and by the court. And, man, when I started writing that.
What happened, Tom? We lost you. Tom?
Yeah.
He's dropped.
He might have got into a good zone.
Yeah. Johnny, you want to talk about any of those names that he mentioned?
Well, I work with Mr. Tony Davis. I was working on this for over 18 years before Mr. Davis contacted me. And we exchanged information, and before Mr. Davis's demise, he sent me the vast majority of his information, and I was able to obtain the rest of his information on his what they call towers. And like I say, I've got all of this documented information, of which I sent Mr. Davis, and he sent me, we exchanged a lot of information on it. And everything is confirming what we do know is an invalid statute. But there is, I would like to, add a little something, if I may add. There is an act which passed the House of Representatives in April of this year. They call it the Moore Act. It's H.R. 3617. Now, this pertains only to the marijuana charges. Title 18 covers a vast majority of different violations, but this one act, the Moore Act, H.R. 3617, passed the House in April. It is coming up for a vote in the Senate in the very near future. And if this, if the Senate votes on it and passes it, this is one little corner of information that we can use to bust Title 18 wide open. Because a lot of these individuals were charged with drug offenses. And this bill legalizes marijuana. And of all the charges invoked, this H.R. 36 would alleviate their convictions. But we've got to get this passed in the Senate. And with this, it would be a cornerstone to build on to eliminate or stifle Title 18. This is just a little information for your public to spread to individuals that have been charged with marijuana violations federally, not state.
Thank you. Thank you.
Am I still on, Mark?
Yes, you're still on. Do you have a comment, and then we're going to bring Jennifer back?
I definitely have a comment. Title 18 under the act of charging people for marijuana, are they charging them as a same class as meth, heroin, cocaine?
Yes, it's under the same classification, but the Moore Act specifically alleviates marijuana from the law. It legalized it in the federal system.
Well, because in 1961, the United States did a treaty with the United Nations, and they took marijuana, cannabis, off of that from number five being the top and moved it down to a number one or something. So international law supersedes national law. That's in the Constitution. Now,
well,
when they make an international law, it overrides any national laws.
I would not bring that up in front of a federal judge because you'll probably add 10 more years to your sentence.
Well, I'm not worried about it. I'm 73 years old and I have no fear.
I've experienced a lot of controversy in the last, let's say, 12 years that I've been assisting legal firms in their defenses, of which sometimes they take my advice and sometimes they don't. But as long as I get paid, I don't care. I just feel sorry for the person that they represent.
Okay. All right. Let's let Jennifer come up, please. I thank you so much for letting Tom and Michael work that out.
Oh, my pleasure. I just wanted to ask, is it Johnny Gringo? Is that his
Ringo.
Name?
Johnny Ringo. Yeah.
You said you had
He's looking for his Huckleberry.
I'm just wondering if he has given copies of or whatever all his documents, so they're never lost. So multiple people have them in different places, even if it's copies of the certified, you know, because too often they come and destroy the one copy, like what happened with John's house burnt down, you know. Anyway, that's the sort of thing I worry about. But also, I wanted to ask Michael, is Title 18 what we were going to use with PJ to go after the local government people regarding territorial land situation?
Title 18, Section 242. Title 18, Section 242, right?
So it is Title 18.
Yeah.
So does that
mean Title 18, Section 242. That's the criminal aspect of deprivation of rights under color of law.
I mean, does that mean that Title 18 is also not actually
same
law
one.
Either?
Oh,
yeah, but what you have to remember is that when you quote the titles and things like that, you quote the statutes, you're quoting what they have in their laws in their jurisdiction. Under the common law, you can simply sit there and say deprivation of rights under color of law. There are no statutes in the common law. There's nothing like that whatsoever. So it's how you phrase it and how you coach it. Anything else, Jennifer?
Well, I mean, if their Title 18 says that, you know, they can be fined and put in jail and whatever for disobeying, does the common law color of title say the same thing?
We have to have first, if we're going to exercise common law, a sufficient number of people who have corrected their status, who have formed a court, and then are coming in as a Seventh Amendment court. And once we have that, and it's organized and it's operating, and there are private attorney generals that are operating as prosecutors, et cetera, or perhaps as judges, then we'll have the mechanism in place to affect a common law court. There are no common. The Constitution gives us Article 3 of the Constitution, they give us this court there. It's an Article 3 court. And there are no Article 3 courts that I know of that are operating for the people in the various states. They're just not there. It may be in Philadelphia operating. It may be what they call the Supreme Court. I don't know. But those Article III courts are the only ones that can actually address the common law. All the courts, without exception, that you walk into today, they're Article I, Section 8 courts.
Yep. Yes,
so that's the difference. Sorry?
Okay. Okay. I also wanted to ask, are the members of the Supreme Court today different to the members of the Supreme Court when they sort of denied the other paperwork? And so could it be presented again to the newer Supreme Court?
Johnny?
I doubt that. If they would, like I said, I've got documentation of 56 government elected officials that were brought before the Supreme Court in various cases, and they were all sealed. I received the documentation through a very expansive financial cost, but I doubt if they would even consider it for the common ordinary individual, unless you're a very high-ranking official or important VIP that this country wants to elevate to Statue of Liberty status. Let's put it that way.
Could you put it all on a disc and send it to Mar-a-Lago to address to Trump?
Well, he was no. I'm neither Republican or Democrat. I vote for the person. I did have hope when he was in office, but that has been waning greatly. Don't get me wrong. I like the man, and to answer your other question, no, nobody else has got the documentation I have got. I have furnished it to people to read and study, but I've never gave any copies out or anything. All this documentation is sealed and is very well protected. And another item I would like to add is that there's 5,173 statutes in Title 18. So that covers a fairly broad spectrum of prosecutions.
Right. Well, that would take a long time to put it on a disk or thumb drive or whatever. But anyway,
all right.
I just have a question for Michael. So do you think PJ will be able to talk to me tomorrow after he hands in the motion that he's doing or the whatever it is he's
that's
doing?
John. It was John that's
oh, John.
Was
John,
scheduled.
John,
yeah. Yeah. Prayerfully so. I mean, I honestly was going to have him talk to you tonight, last night? It's just this thing is snowballing.
Yeah,
and it's got to be taken care of. I want to thank everyone for joining. I'm sorry.
I have nothing to say to the court because I cannot say what he gave me to say because I don't understand any of it, and so I'll be going to court and not know what to say if I cannot talk to him tomorrow.
No, you will talk to him tomorrow. I will see to it.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. I want to thank everyone for joining us on the call tonight. Especially, I want to thank Johnny Ringo for allowing me to blindside him. He's most gracious of him. Remember to join us next week, this Saturday, with Judge Bernie regarding asset protection. GW regarding correcting your status, and we'll have John back Tuesday to show you how to leverage that. Plus, he's going to be talking about personam jurisdiction. So until then, good night, everybody. Thank you, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.